There's good news and bad news. And this joke, by the way, Steve and Tom, is a little too close to home right now for comfort. But he says, comrades, there's good news and bad news. The good news is this. Someday, even the great United States of America will become a socialist country. The bad news, when that happens, there won't be any place left on earth for us to buy grain.
Podcasting from WealthWave Studios in Atlanta, Georgia, this is Leadership Now, the official vision and strategy podcast of WealthWave.
Okay, well, I'm really excited about today's guest. He's the author of over 30 books.
Wow.
I mean, he's written more books than I've read.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, fantastic. But an advisor to two presidents, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So advisor to the White House, the whole thing, Washington insider. And so please welcome to the show, Mr. Doug Weed. Good to see you, Doug.
Welcome, Doug.
Hey, hi, Steve. Hi, Tom.
Great to see you. And we got some of your books here we're going to talk about. So I got to tell you, open up with a story. So,
okay.
So I don't know if you remember this, Doug, but September, so almost 20 years ago to the day, September 10th, 2001,
right.
The day before the world changed.
I remember. Yeah.
I'm sitting in a Mexican restaurant in Scottsdale, Arizona with Doug Weed and our friend Don Stewart. You remember that, Doug?
Yeah.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
So we were talking about that Doug started the National Charity Awards with, was it President Reagan you started it with, Doug?
Well, the first one was actually with Jimmy Carter and Rosalind
Carter. Okay. And then Reagan and then picked it up and...
Yes. The idea started at the Reagan's dinner table, but the first actual event was with the Carters.
Okay. So Doug invited me to be on the board of the National Charity Awards. And
wow.
So then he called maybe another month later and he said, okay, now it's changed because September 11th happened. And then we did the whole thing in Washington and donated all the money to the September 11th fund, wasn't it, Doug? The fire fund?
Yeah. Firemen.
And Doug got
quite,
me on,
it was quite a deal.
One of the best things Doug did for me, he got me on the same panel or board with Cheryl Ladd from Charlie's Angels.
Wow.
So thanks for that, Doug.
Can't beat that.
She was very cute.
I bet
she
was.
This tall, you know?
Yeah.
So we appreciate you being on, Doug. Now, let's talk, first of all, I went through, I know you've written so many books. Now, your latest book is this one, Inside the Trump White House.
Yeah.
This has been a big seller for you, right?
Yeah, a big seller. I got $1 million advance on it. It's the official authorized history of the Trump White House.
Wow.
And while there are so many books that have sources that aren't on the record, and this book has them all on the record. So it's got Donald Trump, who sat down for interviews, and Jared and Ivanka and Tiffany and Donnie and Eric and Lara and all of them. And it's just absolutely fascinating, bird's eye view inside the White House.
And you actually did some of the interviews in the Oval Office, from what I read.
Yeah, a number of them were in the Oval Office and at Jared and Ivanka's home in Georgetown and all over the place, Trump Tower in New York City, wherever they were. I followed them around and got the story. They're fascinating stories and very funny. Soon after he became president, it was very hard on Melania, you know. So the president would tease her. They'd sit down to dinner with the family at dinner table, and Donald Trump would say, Melania, honey, aren't you glad I got elected president of the United States, so now you can be first lady. You'd have never had any of all of this without me. And of course, she who's chafing under all this terrible criticism that she constantly got said, oh yeah, thanks a lot.
I bet. Well, what was it like being in the middle of all that craziness, kind of firestorm with Trump, and sort of as an insider? I mean, very few people have that kind of position. What was it like being in the middle of all that?
It was fascinating to me because it was just the opposite of what the national media was reporting. So I just couldn't get over that. I just captured everything I could. But I thought going in, Steve, I'd worked in the White House, and I knew that what we did in the White House was far more calculated than the national media or political observers ever would have dreamed. So I suspected it must be that way for the Trump White House, too, because it looked so chaotic and haphazard. And when I got in there, I realized, soon learned, that's exactly the case. There was a real genius behind the chaos. I think it was Sun Tzu. He's incorrectly attributed the quote that out of chaos comes opportunity, but that was certainly the case with Trump. He'd blow up NATO, then he'd rebuild it bigger than ever and raise $100 billion for it. He'd blow up NAFTA, and he'd rebuild a better treaty that was much more durable. That was typical of Donald Trump.
Wow. Well, having met all these presidents and worked with them like you have, what would you say is the main difference between somebody who was a career politician that got elected president of the United States and somebody who was a business leader that got elected president? What was the difference?
Well, money, the understanding and knowledge of money for Trump is just striking. A good example is the Afghan crisis unfolding. You know, under Jimmy Carter, we had 52 hostages. It really wasn't Carter's fault. It happened on his watch, and he's criticized for not having a strong enough military to do something about it. But he didn't cause that crisis.
Right, right.
But suddenly, to have thousands of Americans now behind enemy lines, what Trump did when he came into office, there were 55 Americans being held hostage in prisons all over the world, and some of them had been there for two presidencies, all through the Obama presidency and all through the George W. Bush presidency. And the way he got them out was money. He understands money. He understands that you need money. And a lot of politicians don't. They don't understand money. They just print more of it. He understood it. So he did that when he took on ISIS. He dried up their income from the artifacts from the antiquities. He knew they were selling them on the market. So he went after the bank accounts of some of the great collectors around the world, and he dried that up. He knew they were making money off oil. He outlawed that, dried up, went after the banks and held all of that money. ISIS soon had no money. Same happened with the dictators and nations that were holding Americans hostage. He took them to the brink financially, said, "You sure you want to do this?" And they finally gave up, said, "Okay, you can. We'll let him out of prison. You can have him." Because Donald Trump knew how money works and how important it is. Lots of politicians don't.
Wow. Doug, with all the presidents you've known, and he's such a humble guy. You got to ask him. He won't tell us otherwise, probably. But of all the presidents you've worked with and known and have relationships with over the years, who would you say was the best leader of all of them?
Well, I know it's controversial. A lot of your viewers won't like it, but Donald Trump really is a leader. He doesn't follow behind. He stakes out his claim of what he wants to do. When he got into office, on the first day he wanted to win ISIS, on the first day he wanted to solve the Middle East problem. He just is gung-ho, and that's very impressive to me. He's not afraid to set the goals. He told me that when he sat down with Barack Obama after he was elected president, he asked Obama, Trump was the president-elect, said, "What's the biggest problem I'm going to face in my presidency?" And Obama said, "The biggest problem you're going to face is war with North Korea. There will be a war with North Korea on your watch. There's no way out of it." And Trump said, "Well, have you called him?" And Obama said, "No, I haven't called him. He's a dictator." And then Trump looked at me and the others. We were having lunch with him in the Oval Office. He said, "Did you get that?" "No, I didn't call him. He's a dictator." Stupid. This is what Trump was saying. So apparently Donald Trump is of the persuasion, if you got a problem with someone, you pick up the phone and you call them. You don't sit and let it unfold at its own pace. You resolve it. And I think that's leadership. Ronald Reagan struck me as a great leader. And there have been other great leaders among the Democrats, too.
Wow. Great
story. You know, one of the things I've learned is this is my 40th year of being a leader in business. And I'm certainly not on a stage like an elected official, but in our business it's been a big stage. And what I've learned is that when you attempt to be a leader, when you step out and you lead, when you innovate, when you disrupt, you invite criticism. And it seems to me, you know, of course I've followed Trump for many years. I've been following the books he wrote way back, and I feel like sometimes when he was trying to lead and trying to innovate and trying to disrupt like a normal business leader does, that caused him to be attacked. Not that different than you when you're in business, but when you're attacked as a politician on a grand stage like that, it seems like it's everywhere you turn, every magazine, every book, every TV show. And so talk about that for a second. Did you get the same sense?
Well, it's very complex, and it's ties to the economy. A lot of it's related to the international global economy. The name of the game, Tom and Steve, as you very well know, the name of the game is, and always has been, monopoly. The idea is that these big companies want a monopoly, and that means destroying their small business competitors that show up. And the way they destroy their small business competitors is through regulation. So they increase the regulations, which is a burden on them. But more importantly, it's a burden that the small business can't carry. So the small businesses are driven out of the market. And the monopolies, who are wealthy, they can afford to implement these regulations. And then here's the trick. I learned this after 40 years of working with the Bushes and in government and at the White House. I never understood this. There'll be a recession. It may be a Republican, it may be a Democrat president, doesn't matter. There's a recession. And they go to the lobbyists in Washington and say, what can you do to create jobs? We need jobs. And these lobbyists, who all represent the monopolies, none of them represent little businesses, they represent the big monopolies. They say, well, you have all these regulations on us. If you'll give us like a 15-year hiatus, we care about the environment. We want strong regulations against a bad environment. But if you'll give us a 10-year hiatus on this, we can create 50,000 jobs or 100,000 jobs. So these big monopolies who had the regulations against them and used those regulations to drive their competitors out of business, they now are exempted from the very regulations themselves. They don't have to keep them either. So it's really quite a game. And here came Donald Trump. He unleashed these angels of small business, and suddenly a big company like Boeing that had no-bid contracts on many projects now had 40 competitors who were also bidding on some of those government projects. And that was really an amazing phenomenon. It worked for a while. Till with COVID, they shut down all the small business.
Right.
You know, with COVID, Costco didn't shut down. Walmart didn't shut down. None of the big corporations shut down. It was your neighborhood restaurant that was shut down.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. You know, before I want to point out some of these books to our viewers and our listeners here. All the President's Children. I think when I met you, Doug, you were working on this book. This is one of the ones. Phenomenal. Doug is a phenomenal writer. I mean, he's a phenomenal speaker, phenomenal writer. Of course, The Game of Thorns, the book about Hillary Clinton. I know this is one of your most popular books, right, Doug?
Yeah, it did very well.
Phenomenal, phenomenal book. And Doug, you'll love this. I dug back in the archives. You're going to love this. And I found one of your initial, I think one of your first books with Dexter Yeager, Becoming Rich. You see, I bought it from a thrift shop, Doug, at some point. And this is when you had dark hair and I had dark hair. Yeah, I don't even see the picture on the back, but all his books are phenomenal. He's
fantastic.
A great speaker.
Fantastic.
Great writer. Doug, I got to ask you this because, and you tell me if I'm wrong about the setup part of it, but as I understand it, from you told me 25 years ago probably, you were intimately involved, let's say, in getting Reagan represent the liaison, I think you called it, between the religious community, if I'm saying it the right way, and Ronald Reagan, in an attempt to get him elected, is the way I remembered it. Is that true? Is that kind of the way it was set up, that you were part of that push for the religious community to vote for Reagan?
Well, I had a project involved. I wrote the Reagan campaign biography in 1979, and it came out in 1980, and it was the only book out on Reagan at the time. So that was geared towards conservatives, including social conservatives. And then George H.W. Bush had me co-author a book with him that was also designed for evangelicals and social conservatives. So yeah, that's how I got involved.
Okay, so here's my question for you. I know you've probably gotten this a bunch of times. So, you know, like every other viewership and listenership, you know, our people are probably split down the middle in terms of political affiliation. But the one thing, because I know you know that, you know the religious voting bloc probably as well as anybody in this country, how do you reconcile, and I know it's not the first time you've heard this question, but how do you reconcile the religious part of the equation when it comes to Donald Trump, who obviously is not, well, I won't even get into that, but we worked with Trump's organization for 15 years with the Miss USA pageant and whatnot. I never saw Trump as a real religious person in 15 years, but, you know, that is aside, really. But my point is, with the religious community kind of backing Trump in a major way, how do they reconcile that with some of the things Trump has done and said and been accused of over all these years?
Yeah, well, they don't reconcile it, and they don't like many of the, they have much criticism for Trump, and they have criticism for all kinds of people. But we have a two-party system. Some people say we should be like Europe, we should have 12 parties, we should have, but really, all of the world there, it's a two-party system. Because even if you're in a country that has 12 parties, it eventually siphons down and narrows down to two. And there's eventually a choice between the two. So it's not a question of who's the perfect candidate. Maybe the perfect candidate would be, I don't know, Joel Osteen or something for evangelicals. The question is, of the two that were being offered, which one would be best for us and why? And that's usually what it has come down to with evangelicals.
I see. Okay.
And with every other group, too, by the way.
So whatever policies that he's backing, they're going to go more toward the policies as opposed to the personality.
Yes, definitely, as opposed to the personality.
And they're able to leave the personality side out of it and the behavior and all that out of it, kind of.
Yeah. No question about it. I mean, Donald Trump, he's not a diplomat, of course. He's not a politician. But he had just some raw business sense that immediately brought. I give you an example. He was at a meeting with the Pentagon on Afghanistan, and he was going over the line item budget. He saw a huge number, and he said, "What's this?" They said, "That's the Afghan army." "That much?" "Yes, we pay, we have 200,000 members of the Afghan army, and we pay their salary every month. And wouldn't you rather have the Afghan army take the risk and instead of an American soldier be shot, and we can tell the Afghan army where to go and what to do, but that much money? What's their names?" And the Pentagon generals were just stunned and confused. "What's their names?" "Yeah, what's the names of these soldiers?" They said, "Oh, okay, Mr. President, we'll run an audit for you, and we'll try to figure out where all this money's going." And they ran an audit, and the first pass through the audit, they found that 100,000 soldiers, almost half of the Afghan army, did not exist. They were fake names, and the money was going down a rat hole of corruption.
Wow.
That included Afghan and Americans and others benefiting from it. So that's typical Donald Trump. "Give me their name. We're paying this money. Who are we paying it to? Tom and Steve? I want their names." And the audit showed big surprises. Only a businessman would think of that.
That's right.
A politician would think, "Don't bother me."
Interesting. Wow.
Well, you know, along the lines of you saying people have a choice, it seemed to me in the first election that Donald Trump had, where it was him against Hillary, you just couldn't have a more career politician than her, and you couldn't have a more career businessman than him. And so it really was apples and oranges. And I think that the people that picked were the ones that lean either towards business, if you're a business person or owned a company, or if you just were tired of politicians, which I think he spoke to. My mother's a good example. My mom's never been in politics her whole life. She's 83, and she was wearing Trump shirts and going to rallies. And she just wanted something that wasn't that, wasn't the, what she perceived as the status quo of the way politics had always been. Do you think in your being around all this, is that really what Donald Trump did the most? He just totally disrupted the status quo of politics?
Yes, I think he came in and he turned over the tables and he broke the dishes. And that was why I liked him, because I felt that the system was so corrupt and so compromised by international globalism. I wanted someone to mess with it. You know, I'd like to share with you something if I can. In studying these presidents, I've noticed something which I call the man in the shadows, and this applied to Trump, but it applies to many great Democratic presidents too. And that is, I've noticed again and again among presidential families that have written about that there's a very ambitious parent, usually it's a mother, and there's a target of that ambition, usually it's the oldest son. But sometimes, like in the Bush family, it was a younger son. And in the Eisenhower family, it was a younger son. But this ambitious parent will pick that son and anoint them to be successful and promote them and favor them. And again, Tom and Steve, that son will die or will fail. I mean, it happened with the Kennedys. And there's another son who's in the shadows, who's looking on, who's a little envious, who thinks, why not me? I could do something great with my life, like Donald Trump. It was his brother who got all of the extra attention from his father and got all the positions, and Donald Trump was looking on with envy. There's a scene in one of my books where old Joe Kennedy is sitting in the car and it's snowing and freezing and he's got the car heater on. He's talking to a buddy of his and they're watching Jack Kennedy shake hands with men coming out of a factory. He's running for office. And old Joe Kennedy says, I never thought I'd see this in a million years. I always thought it was going to be Joe, the name of his oldest son.
Right.
I always thought Joe would do it. I never thought Jack would do it. I thought he was effeminate. It was the same in the Eisenhower family. It was all Milton in the Bush family. It was all Jeb. I walked into the Oval Office one day and Barbara turned on me and said, you tell George not to run. This was in, 1990, he was considering running for governor of Texas. We don't want him to run, because they were afraid it'd mess it up for Jeb. They expected Jeb to do great things. In fact, that became public. She said, let's face it, George is too much like me. Jeb is like his father. We think Jeb's going to be able to do it. He's the politician. So I call it the man in the shadows. It's even biblical. You'll find it in the Bible where Jesse's father, the prophet Samuel, he meets all of Jesse's sons and he says, I can't figure out. I was sure it was one of them. Are these all your sons? Yep, these are all my kids. Well, there's David, you know, he's out with the sheep, but he's the youngest one. Well, go get him. So they go get David. It's the man in the shadows. And I've just seen this. It's almost like God prowls the shadows looking for the son or the daughter that got passed over. And they're under no pressure. There's no parent saying, you got to get an A on this test. And in that relaxed atmosphere, they're able to develop and excel and do great things with their lives. I've seen that again and again among the presidents.
Fascinating.
I'm so glad you told that story because I don't know if you remember this, Doug, but you told that story the time we were working in Mexico on that cruise boat with all those people. You told that story and I followed you. I listened to you because I was backstage. I listened to you and then I spoke. And I literally told that story, what you just told. Of course, it's your third person, but all over the world. I've told that story for years. I haven't heard you say that story in God, 20 years or 15 years or whatever it's been. So the Barbara Bush story with that she didn't want George W. to run. It's a great story, man. You can't follow Doug Weed on a stage. I followed him in Mexico. I followed him in Toronto and the States all over. You cannot follow. He is the best public speaker out there.
Wow.
He's just too good. Well, you're just too good.
The other thing that I've taken from this study of the president, Steve and Tom, that really stays with me is I was surprised when I wrote The Raising of a President, how abusive their parents were, how abusive Abraham Lincoln's dad, he'd knock him to the ground with his fist. He said he's lazy. All he does is read books, and he treated him awfully. And FDR had a mother. He wrote his brother and said, when he was 9 years old, I had my first bath without my mother. This was typical. A lot of these children who become president were abused in their childhood. And so when I studied that and I learned that and they become president of the United States, I realized that the things that people do to us and say to us as children, they don't have to hold us back. We are not prisoners of what our mother did or our father did, or brother or some school teacher said about us. That's fake. We are free to do whatever we want in life and become whatever we want to become in life, because so many of these presidents, they become the president of the United States and they're abused as children. That was very liberating for me. And anybody listening to that, I think should take that to heart. Don't use that as an excuse. You are not a prisoner of what happened to you in your childhood.
Wow.
Makes sense, yeah. You know, being around all these presidents, Doug, have you ever thought that you would ever want to do that someday? Or, well, I always think to myself, who would want that job at any price? You know, I mean, what's your take on that? Is it an attractive position to you or not?
No, not at all. I guess I'm chicken. when you get into the arena like that, you really get slaughtered. It's it's quite a process. So I enjoyed. My role was to write about it.
Wow. When you walked in the Oval Office, and you walk in this room where history has been made so many times and times and times, what's the first thing that hit you when you got in there and you looked around? And were you thinking about all the other people that have been in there? Were you thinking about meetings and events? Or what went through your mind?
Well, the first time I was in the Oval Office was I was on staff with the President of the United States. So I was under tremendous pressure to perform. So I didn't have the luxury of going in and saying, oh, this is nice.
Yeah, right,
all the
right.
things that happened. I was bringing in the president of the U.S. Olympic Committee, and the president of the United States was going to pitch him on the Atlanta Olympics, that America wanted to have the Olympics in Atlanta. So I had to write choreograph that whole thing. What would the president say? What was Sam Araachi going to say? And how could the president answer him? And I had to go through all that because the president doesn't have time for that. So I had to research and be prepared and anticipate everything Sam Araachi would say to the president and what the president should answer. So I was too busy in my mind to say, well, this is fascinating. This is the Oval Office. I was focused. But I did, later I did, when I went in to interview Trump, that was kind of fun because he's such a character. I walk into the Oval Office and Ivanka said, Dad, here's the guy that got us our jobs, Jared and I, our jobs on the White House staff. And he said, hi. And the president was holding up these papers above his head. And he looked at me and he said, these are my secret correspondence with Kim Jong-un. They didn't want me to let you have them, but I'm going to let you read them. You can't take them, but I'm going to let you sit down and read through this correspondence. So that was pretty exciting.
I bet.
That's amazing.
Talk about the inside scoop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Were you impressed with the correspondence?
Yeah. They actually set aside, I had lunch with the president, then they set aside a room for me to take my time to read through it. And it was very ornate. The Koreans are very formal and ornate, and they have ribbons and foils and inks and seals on their original documents, and they're in Korean, of course. And then there's the CIA translations in English underneath them. So it was very interesting to see this. And you could see that Kim and Trump had quite a relationship going on.
Wow. So overall, would you, and maybe I'm putting you on the spot with this, maybe I shouldn't ask you this, but I was just going to ask you, of all the presidents you've known, who is the best in terms of authentic leadership, let's say? I mean, and I know you just wrote the book on Trump, so I know that's probably part of it, but
yeah, and I know that makes people angry and everything, but I, for my own reasons, I have to tell you, I'm deeply impressed with what Trump did and tried to do for the economy and for the Middle East. But I was very impressed with Ronald Reagan. There were limits to how far he would go, but he won the Cold War and he knew how to back off. He was a lot better politician than Donald Trump. But to give you one more example, insider example of Trump, when he came in, he asked Obama, what's the most serious problem we face? And Obama said war in Korea. And then he said, what's the biggest problem in the world? And they said, peace in the Middle East. So afterwards, he and Jared had a conversation about it. And I asked the president about it. I said, how were you able to move the American embassy to Jerusalem? I mean, six presidents before you promised to do that, and they didn't do it. Clinton said he was going to do it, and he made fun of his predecessor. George W. Bush attacked Clinton and ridiculed him and said, I'm going to do it on day one. Clinton promised, and in 8 years he didn't do it. I'll do it on day one. And he never did it in 8 years. So how was it when you came into power that you were able to move that? What did you learn that we don't know, that all these other presidents learned when they became president? He said, I'll tell you what it was. As soon as I became president, I got a call from Emmanuel Macron. He said, if you move that embassy to Jerusalem, there'll be a war in the Middle East and 100,000 people will die. And I got a call from Erdogan of Turkey. He said, if you move that embassy, there will be war in the Middle East. And we know, we've already run the numbers and the military gains. 100,000 people will die in the Middle East if you do that. That's what will happen. So that's why all the other presidents backed down. So I said, why did you do it? He said, well, there are two things every president wanted: peace in the Middle East and to move the American embassy. That's what they wanted. And they said, we can't move the embassy because if we do that, we can't have peace in the Middle East. So they'd never move the embassy, hoping they'd have peace in the Middle East, which never happened. So I said, well, I'll move the embassy. And then at least I'll get one of them. And who knows, maybe I'll get peace in the Middle East too. So he moved the embassy and he pulled off the Abraham Accords, which was pretty remarkable. And that's typical Trump.
Wow, that really is. Well, when you wrote this book, the Inside Trump's White House, the real story of his presidency, what do you think makes this the real story? Is this just the access you had to get the real scoop out of him?
Yeah, and out of the whole family. It's comical. There's a scene in the book where these beautiful women, Melania and Ivanka and Tiffany and Lara, and they go to the inauguration. They go to the event the night before at the Lincoln Memorial, and then they go to St. John's Church that morning, and then they go to the inauguration. They wear these 6-inch high heels. So they're going up these marble slippery steps of the Capitol and the Lincoln Memorial, and where you have to take two steps to get one because they're so long, the steps, in these high heels. And then they have the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue and the cars stop and the ladies have to get out of the cars. They have to walk in their high heels for 500 yards down the street. And they finally get to the White House and they go to the inaugural ball. And they slide all over the floors at the inaugural ball in their high heels. And they go to bed. And the next morning, they have one last event at St. John's Church. I'm sorry, the cathedral. And so it's not at St. John's, the National Cathedral. So they've got to go to one more event. They got to get into their high heels again. So they're all staying in the White House. And Laura comes down one of the hallways and she screams and says, "I can't get in my high heels. My feet are swollen." And you hear these screams all over the White House from all the other Trump women. It's the same thing. Their feet are swollen. So if you can picture this, here are these wonderful, beautiful women, and the butlers are bringing them big tubs of ice water, and they're sticking their feet in the ice water to try to reduce the swelling. So one more time, they can get into their high heels.
Wow. That's
the sort of thing you get in an insider book that you won't get in a history book where all the sources are anonymous.
Right.
Sure, sure. Doug, what was your take on Mary Trump's book? I read that one. I know it's kind of the other side of the coin, but what was your take on that?
Well, I found it very interesting. I like to hear from everybody. There's always a family member who resents the president. There's a Billy Carter. He used to joke. He joked about it when Jimmy first started running for president. He had his sister, Ruth Carter Stapleton, who was a Pentecostal healing evangelist. So Billy Carter would say, "I got a sister who thinks she can heal people. I got a brother who thinks he's going to be president of the United States. I'm the only sane one in the bunch." That was Billy Carter.
And he had Billy Beer. So, remember Billy Beer?
I do.
Yeah.
I think I might have had a couple cans of Billy Beer.
Wow. But there was Nixon had a brother who, you know, well, look at Joe Biden's got a son that's kind of a rascal. And very common. FDR had a son who worked against him to try to get him elected, voted out of office. He worked for the Hearst radio networks and had his own anti-FDR radio show. Ronald Reagan Jr. Didn't like Ronald Reagan's policies, and Patty Reagan appeared for Playboy. So all through history, you have this. And I'm surprised that the Trumps have been as cohesive as they have. And they had to reach out to a niece that's really outside of the inner circle to get a critic.
Wow. Doug, what's your take on Jimmy Carter's legacy? Obviously, he's done so much outside of, you know, after being the president. He's still going at, what, 97 or 96?
Right, right.
He lives not too far. We're in Atlanta. He lives not too far from here. But what's your take on his post-presidency?
Well, he's certainly one of the greatest, if not the greatest, and I think probably he is the greatest former president in American history, because others have done things, but he set the pace and scrupulously honest. And while presidents have made a fortune and set up foundations and it's turned into practically bribery, Jimmy Carter has been very clean. He was the last president before Trump not to have invaded somebody. He believed what he believed, and he didn't start wars. And as I mentioned before, he didn't start the Iran hostage crisis. That happened on his watch. But he didn't do the things that provoked it to happen, which is a big difference. But it's true that we had inflation reached 14% a month, if you can imagine that. People don't understand inflation and how it actually destroys their income and how devastating it is to the poor. But yeah, it's a tough thing. Wow. But a lot of good things about him too.
Well, I know that you wrote this Game of Thorns book, which is fascinating. So I know you're not a big Clinton fan. So any comments on the Clinton presidency or even Hillary, which obviously this is a big part of this book is about. Any comments about that and thoughts about Hillary Clinton's? It sure seemed like she was going to win. I mean, it just, that was a slam dunk, right? And then it didn't happen.
Yeah. In fact, I had a contract the night of the election. I lost my contract. I had a contract to write a book called First Man, Bill Clinton in Hillary's White House. I had already written the outline for 16 chapters, submitted it to a publisher, received an advance, six-figure advance, and was going to write that book. And then Donald Trump won the election. My agent called me up and said, "You know, you're going to have to return your advance because it's in your contract. Hillary had to win the election." So So I took a walk with my daughter. I said, this is my income for a year. I'm cooked. And I called my agent back and I said, do you think there's a chance I could turn this into a book about the election? She said, well, I've never heard of anybody doing that, taking a contract they got on a book and turning it into a different book, but you can try. So I called my editor and I said, look, I've written four chapters of this book. They're all about Hillary because it's the book's going to be about Bill Clinton and Hillary's White House, but I could adapt it to a book about the election. And is there a chance? She said, well, I've never heard of that before, but I'm having dinner tonight with the president of the publishing company. You get me a title and you get me 500 words. We'll see what he says. So I got them a title, Game of Thorns, and I got them 500 words. And they said, okay, we'll keep your contract. You can write a book about the election.
Wow. Well, good pivot on that one, Doug. That was
It was close. That was close.
See, I never thought you were a big fan of the Clintons. I always had a feeling that you were not, you know, I know that you're a writer and you're a historian, I think, the way, right? And so I know you can probably be neutral, but I never felt like you liked the Clintons that much. You were a big fan.
Well, I'm a big fan of all of them. I admire them for getting in there, and I don't. I try to keep my criticism non-personal, and I was upset with the Clinton Foundation because money given to the Clinton Foundation did have ramifications. There was a billionaire from Nigeria that gave $1 million to the Clinton Foundation, who owned big hotels, and the Boko Haram of Nigeria were never declared as terrorists because it would have hurt tourism in Nigeria. And the President Obama wanted it, and Secretary of State Kerry wanted it, called for it, and they had threatened the ambassador to Nigeria, the American ambassador, and Kerry followed Hillary as Secretary of State. So, but she wouldn't do it. And I wondered if that $1 million donation made a difference. I know when Trump became president, Boeing came in and said, okay, where's our, you know, $14 billion to build the new Air Force One or whatever it was. I can't remember the exact amount. And Trump said, wait a minute. You gave $1 million to the Clinton Foundation. All of your top executives maxed out their highest donations to Clinton running for president. And you want $14 billion from the Trump administration or whatever it is to build the new Air Force One. I'm in no hurry for Air Force One. We're going to have to talk about this. And I can tell you right now, it's going to have to come in under budget and it's going to have to come in on time or you're not going to get anything. So that was Trump.
I love it. Wow. You know, it reminds me of that story from the New England Patriots with Tom Brady when they were 18-0 going in the Super Bowl. So they were so confident they were going to beat the Giants, they trademarked 19-0. And then they lost. And when they interviewed one of the guys on the Giants after the game, he said, I guess they should have trademarked 18-1. And I felt that about when Hillary lost. I thought she kind of went into that very confident, thinking she was going to, it was done.
Yeah.
And a lot of Democratic friends of mine were just very confident. And somehow something told me that the disruptor, the person that was going to pull everybody together that way, that there was not, people were just tired of following career politicians.
Yeah.
I think they still are. I don't know what that bodes for Trump. Probably nothing. But it's fascinating to me that this, your book here just basically tells you the whole story of what happens when you try and lead in that style in politics.
Well, it's fascinating. The other lesson I take away from this, Tom and Steve, is to don't underestimate your chances. You know, we tend to write it off. I can't do that. I can't do this. These presidents show you can. I mean, look at Bill Clinton. You got to give him a lot of credit. He had a lot of scandals. Most people that had lived the life of Bill Clinton would never run for president. He just put it out on the table. He ran anyway. And he had to live down a lot of the scandals that came out. But he didn't let it hold him back.
You know, we've always said that possibility projections can lead to impossibility achieving. And after talking to you, it's really reminding me that these guys that run for president just think they can do that. It sounds impossible, but they think they can do it, which is why they do.
Unbelievable.
Amazing, isn't it?
Doug, you've told me so many stories over the years about George W. Bush, who I know has been a good friend of yours for a long time. What's the best story you could tell us that you could actually say in an interview that you could tell us about George W. Bush?
Well, I was sitting with George W. Bush in his office after his dad won the presidency, and we were talking about the inaugural and who would go on the transition committee and who would work in the White House. And as we were sitting there talking about it, he said, "What's going to happen to me?" Well, that was very unusual for him. He was not a self-reflective person. And I was a bit shocked, caught off guard by it. I said, "Well, I knew what he meant. He didn't mean what's going to happen to me. We knew he was going to run for governor of Texas. We knew he was going to buy the Texas Rangers. He was already on the phone the last month talking to people, chomping on a dry cigar and saying on the phone, you want to buy a baseball team? We're going to buy a baseball team." So he was on his way to do that. So we knew that. But when he said, "What's going to happen to me?" he was asking, "What does it mean to be the son of an American president? How's that going to impact me?" I said, "Well, you want me to do a memo on what happens to children of presidents?" He said, "Yeah, do a memo." So I did a memo, and that eventually led to the book, the New York Times bestseller, All the President's Children. But when I did the memo, it came back, the information came back, and it was horrendous what happens to presidential children. They do great things, but they have terrible things happen to them. And one is it's almost like a curse. If you're named after your father, the president, it's just, I mean, John Tyler Jr. dies an alcoholic in his 20s, and William Henry Harrison Jr. dies an alcoholic in his 20s. Calvin Coolidge Jr. dies after a freak accident on the White House tennis courts. And George W. Bush, he's not a junior, but that's what we called him. That's what he wanted for a long time. We called him Junior. George W. Bush. I was listening to a car radio, and the story came on the car radio. John F. Kennedy Jr.'s airplane had just disappeared over the Atlantic. I had chills go down my spine. I thought, this is unbelievable. This happens over and over throughout history. What is this? And I really believe it's the pressure of expectations. From the time they're little kids, children come up to them, John F. Kennedy Jr., and they say, "When are you going to run for president?" Imagine getting that. And it was even worse with him because his dad was murdered. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to do anything about this? What are you going to do? When are you going to be president? Imagine the pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why these children broke. They broke under the pressure. But George W. Bush, who was an alcoholic for a while, he had some severe problems. He beat it, and he changed, and he became president of the United States. He did not fall into that syndrome. He stopped it just cold. "I'm not going to do that." And that's very impressive to me.
How about Ronald Reagan? He's, you know, it's interesting, Doug. I think anyway that, you know, Reagan during his time, and there was a lot of controversy, Iran-Contra and all the rest of it. But now he's almost a deity. He's almost, it's all right. Time does something. What's your best Ronald Reagan story? I know you get introduced in your speeches with the Ronald Reagan video, which is really hard to follow too.
Yeah, that's hard to follow. Yeah.
Ronald Reagan introduces Doug basically in the speech. So what's your best story on that one, Doug?
Yeah, with Reagan. I mean, he won the Cold War, and that, you know, you can say Lincoln saved the nation. Ronald Reagan saved humanity. I mean, at the time, school teachers in Holland were telling their children, it doesn't matter where you go to college because the world is not going to survive. By the time you're in college, it will be over. They expected the world to end in the nuclear annihilation. So he's pretty hard to beat. He's one of the greatest presidents in history. But what I liked about it was his jokes. He told all these wonderful jokes And about the Soviet Union, here's one that I find especially funny: good news and bad news. And the teacher, the political teacher, is telling the kids, comrades, there's good news and bad news. And this joke, by the way, Steve and Tom, is a little too close to home right now for comfort. But he says, comrades, there's good news and bad news. The good news is this: someday, even the great United States of America will become a socialist country. The bad news, when that happens, there won't be any place left on earth for us to buy grain. So that's his joke. That was a joke in the Soviet Union. They made fun of the fact that socialism doesn't work. And it's not too funny now that I think about it, because America's on the verge of socialism.
You know, President Reagan was funny. There's a video on YouTube that's 45 minutes long of just all the funny things he said in his talks and all the way throughout his whole presidency. And one of them was really funny, where he said somebody came in his office and slammed his fist on his desk and said, I don't agree with you. And the guy said, well, you can't do that in Russia. And he said, oh, yes, you can. You can go in there and you can slam your fist on the desk and say, I don't like Reagan.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
You can say the same thing. Yeah. And he delivered it. He was an actor, and he was a politician, but he was used to delivering his lines, and they were flawless.
Was he a pretty nice guy, Doug, personally?
Very nice guy, and I underscore what Tom just said. He rehearsed that joke that he gives so casually in the debate with Mondale.
That was so great.
Really, oh, that was good.
The timing, I will not exploit your youth and inexperience.
Yeah, he had to master that timing. He had to discipline himself, not rush ahead, couldn't have any twinkle in his eye to give it away where he was going, had to be absolutely straight before he pulled the trigger. And that was masterful, and he was a great actor. I remember, Steve, now that you mentioned it, being on the stage with him from time to time, and he would tell this story, this great story, and it was a tearjerker, and he'd end his speech with it, and the audience would be just moved to tears. It was very emotional. So we were in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he was running for president, and I had given my speech. Now, he was speaking right after me. So he gets up and he gives his speech, and when he starts to give his speech, in walks the media. So they come in and they set up their scaffolding and they set up their cameras, and there's kind of a break in the action before Reagan comes to the microphone, and they're all lined up, hundreds of them, and big bright lights on. And so here's an audience of 15,000, but 400 of them are the American media, and they're all set to go. So Reagan gives his speech, and he starts towards the end, and I think, wait till this happens, wait till he gives this, because I know everybody's going to be crying. And he gives his speech, and so help me, he pulls his punches. It wasn't as hot as he usually gives it. I thought, he didn't do very good. What's the deal? Later, I saw the excerpt on TV, and I realized, this is a master. He understands the difference between hot and cold. And if you're speaking from stage, remember, they always thought Julie Andrews wouldn't be a good actress. So they had Audrey Hepburn play My Fair Lady. And they finally said, okay, they'd let Julie Andrews try on Sound of Music. And she made the transition. But when you're on stage, like Julie Andrews was, you have to belt it. They've got to be able to hear it on the last row, even your stage whisper. It's very different from on camera, where you have to be very subtle and very cool. And otherwise, you come off too animated and you scare the audience. And so that's what Reagan was doing. He knew that there were 15,000 people in the hall, but there were 15 million or more who would see excerpts from this on national television. And he couldn't be hot. He couldn't come off as scary, and he had to tone it down. That was the master.
Wow, that's great.
That's good.
Well, Doug, we could ask you questions all day. You are a national treasure, and we really appreciate you coming on the show. I got to tell you one thing I've been wanting to tell you for so long. This is typical Doug Weed. It's right here. It's I was talking to our mutual friend before he died, Rich DeVos, who we both knew for a long time. And I said to Rich, because I had known Rich for a long time over the years, I'd interviewed him. Of course, I know you knew him better than I did even. But I said to him, I said, you know, we were talking about speaking and about Bill Gove and that whole thing, right? And I said, he said, what's your favorite two speeches? I said, I'm glad you asked. I said, Selling America. You remember Selling America, Rich? Okay, greatest speech.
Great.
You know, one of the greatest speeches I ever heard. I said, Selling America is my favorite. And I said, do you still have that on tape, Rich, or on any kind of recording? He goes, I haven't seen that like since the 60s. And I said, he said, what's your second one? I said, my second favorite one is Doug Weed, David, and Goliath, which he spoke on your stage way back. And I think it's the 70s you gave that speech. And I had that tape forever, and I wore both of those tapes out. And Rich said, I have a copy of that tape. I always wanted to tell you that. He goes, no, I've got Doug on tape. Yeah, I still have that cassette. He said, I don't have Selling America, but I got David and Goliath. And I wanted to tell you that for a lot of years, especially since Rich has passed away. He was a good guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, and you've had a tremendous career, Steve. You're really an icon to all of us who've been in speaking over the years.
Well, thanks, Doug. I appreciate it. It's always such an honor to be on stage with you. Nobody can follow you, but it's been a lot of fun trying. Definitely, we really appreciate you taking time, Doug. We know you're busy, and congratulations on all the success, Doug. If someone wants to follow you, because I know that you know the Trump book is controversial to people because it's so polarized, as you know better than anyone. But there are Trump fans. We have Trump fans, of course. We have non-Trump fans. But even for the people that are not Trump fans, where would they? Which books would you recommend them starting out with to follow you? And where can we find these books to follow you?
Yeah, well, you go to dougweed.com, which is dougweead.com, and if they love history, they would love The Raising of a President, because it's the only book ever written about the mothers and fathers of all the American presidents. It's a remarkable book and a remarkable study of how these presidents were raised. There have been books on the mothers, books on the fathers, but not the triad together. And then All the President's Children is just fascinating. I wrote that before Trump's presidency, but it is just interesting and fascinating.
Yeah, your books are phenomenal, Doug. You're an amazing writer. I read your stuff and I look at my stuff and I go, oh boy, I need to get better. I need to improve. Again, thanks so much, Doug. We really appreciate you coming. It's great to see you again.
Thank you, Steve and Tom.
Thank you for tuning in to Leadership Now, WealthWave's official podcast. If you like this episode and want to hear more, check out wealthwave.com/podcast or Leadership Now on iTunes. Join us each week to grow as an entrepreneur and succeed as a leader in the financial business with WealthWave.